This week we'll look at madness, desperation and psychological destruction. And given that this is a podcast on nuclear war, I'm really quite surprised that we haven't looked at this before. We'll ask what a nuclear war might do to someone's psychological health. Although if you can't be bothered listening to the end, I'll give you a spoiler. It would ruin it, good and proper. How would a nuclear war and the subsequent collapse of civilised society cause people to react? With violence or with its opposite, apathy? And did government plans have any room for psychological treatment of survivors? Spoiler again? Well, you hardly need one, do you? We all know the answer. But they did have another way of dealing with those of us who were a tad upset by the nuclear holocaust. This is The Atomic Hobo, and I'm Julie McDowell. How would you react in a nuclear war? We only know when we have nightmares about it, but we don't know the reality of it. All that scientists, sociologists and psychologists can do is study human behaviour in other disasters. Earthquakes, fires, floods, stampedes, panics, and of course the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the firestorms in Tokyo, Dresden, Hamburg, and try and extrapolate from those horrors how we would react in the run-up to and in the aftermath of a nuclear war. But with respect to, of course, everyone who suffered terribly and died in all those previous events, they can't compare to an all-out thermonuclear war. Nothing can compare to that. So all we can do is have some good, gruesome guesses at how psychology would respond to nuclear war. And it's not a pretty picture. In 1985, the British Psychological Society published a booklet called Psychological Aspects of Nuclear War, and that's going to be our main source for this podcast. And I'm glad it exists because the BMA, the British Medical Association, published in 1983 a spectacular book called The Medical Effects of Nuclear War. And this was a huge study done by the BMA, which basically attacked ruthlessly and with brilliant expertise, of course, all of the government's civil defence plans for coping with nuclear war. But it doesn't really focus on the psychological impact on survivors. It's mainly, of course, about the physical side of things. So it's good that the Psychological Society came along with their booklet a few years later, focusing on what it would do to us mentally. Let's start with how people would respond to a nuclear warning. The study makes it clear that we humans love denial. So when the news began to get grim and warn of approaching nuclear war, some of us, many of us, would refuse to accept it. We'd flatly refuse to accept it. Or we'd be nicely confident that it will all blow over. Maybe in today's climate, these people would gladly call it fake news. God knows what Twitter would look like in the run-up to a nuclear war. Denial, of course, is a way of coping and adapting by simply holding up your hand and saying, no, it won't happen. But even when it seems obvious that war will come, many of us would seek to psychologically protect ourselves with what the author James Thompson calls the myth of personal invulnerability. We'll be unable to imagine our own deaths in this war. Surely we'll survive. We won't be buried under the rubble. We wouldn't be vaporised in a flash. How can I vanish? It can't be me. It'll be others. How can I cease to exist in a millisecond? This myth of invulnerability is very tough, says the author, and it can hold out until impact. Until we dissolve into singed atoms and think in our very last fragment of consciousness. Oh no, it did get me after all. there are also differences in how we'd react to warnings based on our age. Older people may listen carefully and believe everything or much that the established media tell them. For an example of that, look at Hilda and Jim from When the Wind Blows. Jim very carefully studies the newspapers and scans all the public information advice, looking for help and assistance and instruction. Whereas the younger, less deferential people won't be so ready to cling to what the established media is telling them. Instead, in the absence of a reliance on media, they'll be susceptible to rumour and misinformation and therefore potential panic. And again, we can't help thinking of Twitter, the role that Twitter would play in all of this. If we're talking about abandoning what some people call the mainstream media and turning instead to rumour and misinformation. However, previous podcasts, I believe, have talked of the shutting down of the telephone system in the run-up to a nuclear war. The government would plan to close down most of our telephone lines so that the system wouldn't be overloaded, leaving important lines open for government and the military, etc. So we can assume that perhaps in the modern age they could also perhaps look at closing down Twitter if that was stirring up panic and misinformation. So how would we react after the bomb had dropped? According to the study, we would switch from the theory of personal invulnerability, that warm, comforting idea that it can't possibly happen to me, to what is called the illusion of centrality. So we'd flip from one extreme to the other. Instead of thinking it'll never happen to me, we'd now be convinced it's all happening to me. We're at the centre of the drama. This illusion of centrality makes you think you're at the epicentre, and to be fair, all the rubble and flame around you would only reinforce that idea. Such a viewpoint would prevent people acting as a rational mass, as chess pieces on a board, as we discussed in our previous podcast. That was how some government planners saw the population after a nuclear war, as chess pieces on a board who can be simply moved from place to place and be easily controlled. They didn't factor panic or confusion or terror into their plans. So now, after the bomb has dropped, after the worst disaster thinkable has occurred, many people would be consumed with this illusion of centrality and would think they were at the centre of it, and they and their survival was what mattered. That probably lends a bit of selfishness to their actions. So instead of doing the wisest, most obvious, most rational, sensible thing for the good of society, for the good of their neighbours, they'd hunker down and concentrate on themselves or on their immediate family and immediate situation. So the former myth of personal invulnerability has totally disintegrated and bewilderment has taken its place. All certainties have crumbled. You thought you'd be safe and now the complete opposite has occurred. You perceive that you are at the centre of the worst horror imaginable. And of course, this bewilderment, this horror, this feeling that everything certain and sure has gone will only be worsened when it becomes obvious that no one is coming to help you, that the police aren't around, that there's no doctor for you, there's no ambulance or fire engine making its way across the rubble, no one is coming to help you. Once that terrible realisation sets in, it's then that what they call disaster syndrome begins to manifest itself. Now, the term disaster syndrome, it implies, of course, panic, and yet it's the opposite. People who have studied earthquakes and catastrophic floods, for example, and of course the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, identified disaster syndrome, and it doesn't contain panic. Hollywood might tell us that, but it's actually the opposite. People who are suffering disaster syndrome seem totally apathetic. To quote from the study, victims appear dazed, stunned, and bewildered. To take another Hollywood cliche, they almost seem like zombies. Think of the scene in Threads after the attack, where the survivors are all shuffling into the hospital in Sheffield. They're not pushing and shoving and screaming. They're all just silently shambling and shuffling into the hospital, hoping for help rather than demanding it. So that is a portrayal of disaster syndrome. People are apathetic, helpless, silent. There's no panicking and screaming. Now, why do people behave this way? Why does disaster syndrome prompt this apathetic behaviour? Well, according to the study, there are several theories. One is that passivity is a way of protecting yourself, your psychological self, from any further emotional batterings or turmoil. It could also be a form of wishful thinking. If I sit here quietly, maybe nothing bad will happen. If I run around panicking and looting and screaming and battering people, then I might invite more horror. But if I sit very quietly, if I surrender, maybe it will all go away. Another theory is that disaster syndrome and the passivity and bewilderment and hopelessness it brings is simply a rational response to feeling utterly helpless in a destroyed world. Now, of course, people react differently, particularly those who are already suffering from a psychological disorder. Whether the disorder was bad enough to have them hospitalised or medicated, or whether their behaviour was kept in check by the constraints of a functioning civilised society, those restrictions, those medicines, those bars are now gone. And to quote from the study, this crisis will provide an opportunity which some will be willing to exploit. Some people whose nature, particularly those of a psychopathic disorder, they will react very differently. They will not have this mild, meek, bewildered passivity. They will react very differently and, as the document says, could be willing to exploit the situation. So, when the all clear sounds, when the immediate danger has passed, what happens then? Now, of course, in the context of a thermonuclear war, it's ludicrous to talk of an all clear or the prospect of the immediate danger having passed. Once the bomb is dropped, you could argue that the worst danger is only just beginning, because it's then that the radiation is unleashed and that the collapse of society begins. But nonetheless, when the bombs have stopped dropping and the survivors can emerge from any shelter or hole they've managed to find, it's then that those with a psychotic disorder can perhaps give free rein to that disorder and its destructive qualities. The study says that wild behaviour can be expected. After the bomb, when civilised society and all its little constraints have been smashed, people with these psychotic tendencies can let them run free. We can expect looting and violence and drunkenness and rape. Whereas the more rational amongst us would perhaps begin to try and pull themselves together, to use an awful cliche, and to try and start to seek information. Those with a psychopathic personality might just be having a very wild and violent time. Added to that is the fact that a lot of criminals will have been released into the population prior to nuclear war. If you look back at my previous podcast called Get Out of Jail Free, you'll see that there were plans to empty the prisons of most criminals and release them back into society. So, in this lawless, smashed, devastated society, you will have people with a psychopathic disorder who no longer have treatment or any kind of constraint, whether that's a physical constraint or a sociological constraint. They will be unfettered, and there will be a whole lot of criminals joining them. So we can expect, as we said earlier, drunkenness, violence, looting, rioting, and rape. What about the rational people, which we hope would be the majority? As I say, those who haven't been completely disabled by disaster syndrome will start to look for information, look for ways to perhaps be practical. But the study raises the very disturbing fact that in their desperation and bereavement, many people will start to say, who's to blame for all of this? They will want a scapegoat, so perhaps that's normal human behaviour. They will want someone to blame. And because the Prime Minister or the top generals won't be sauntering through the rubble towards you, you can't grab them and hold them up as the scapegoat. Instead, if you're lucky, it will be doctors and nurses, charity workers, civil defence workers who are coming towards you to offer help. And they, however vaguely, will represent authority. And so it could be them, those people trying to do good, upon whom the angry and the furious turn their rage. And that really is a horrifying thought. Now, what chance is there of psychological treatment after nuclear war? Well, the chances are zero. If you look at my previous podcast called The Doctor Won't See You, it shows how the NHS would fall apart after a single atomic bomb, let alone a full thermonuclear war. So we're talking about people being left to die without so much as a simple paracetamol to ease a bit of their pain. So there's no chance of sitting down on a leather couch to talk about your relationship with your father. There will be no psychological or psychiatric treatment after the bomb. Those with psychological problems, no matter how severe, will simply go untreated. And hundreds of thousands more will develop similar psychological problems. So, don't the government care about the mental health of their surviving population? We know that they've made all these plans for nuclear war. Didn't the mental health of their people factor into that at all? The answer is no. They cared about controlling the survivors, not comforting them. Now that sounds like something a conspiracy theorist with 7 Twitter followers might say. But it is true, it is there in black and white. Plans for Britain's recovery after nuclear war are all about, when it comes to the population, about controlling them, about the absolute desperation to maintain law and order. We must control and contain this damaged, angry, desperate population. There's no time for soothing and healing them. The psychiatrist's couch will be replaced with a rifle. Law and order is what matters, not sturdy mental health. And this brings us neatly to the whole crux of Britain's nuclear war planning in the mid to latter Cold War. It was mainly forget the people, concentrate instead on making sure the state survives. And a cynical, cold person might say, well, that's quite rational because you can't protect and save the population from the hydrogen bomb, from a thermonuclear war. You can't do it. So you may as well devote most of your resources to trying to make sure the state survives, that there is still something there other than a scrap of geography once known as the United Kingdom. And so attention is given to keeping your survivors orderly and obedient, controlling them so that you can make them work and, in theory at least, rebuild society, get industry and agriculture working again. And to do that, you'd have to force them to work, of course. No one's going to feel like bouncing out of bed to go to work in the morning in your post-Holocaust world. So with the threat of guns or with the threat of the withholding of food, the government will control the survivors. But what about those who can't be controlled? Again, I refer you back to my previous podcast, Get Out of Jail Free, where you'll see that authorities plan to empty the jails of most criminals So they would be at liberty in this ruined society, along with, as we know, that 1% of the population who have psychopathic tendencies. Those people can't be easily controlled. And that, of course, is where the gun and the threat of starvation will have to be brought to bear. I'll quote here from a recent article on the Wellcome Institute's website by Taris Young, which talks about the issue of that small percentage of the population who are psychopathic and what will happen with them after nuclear war. It says, making up around 1% of the population, psychopaths were expected to show, quote, no psychological effects in the communities which suffer the severest losses, end quote. The report added, they are very good in crises, as they have no feelings for others, no moral code, and tend to be very intelligent and logical. Pre-strike, the only solution for these people is to contain them. Post-strike, the authorities may find it advantageous to recruit these people, as they could prove an exceptionally valuable resource. End quote. Would we have the situation where the people holding those rifles, the people controlling that precious food supply, and thereby controlling the survivors, would they be, of course, soldiers, the military, but would they also be these psychopaths in the population, this 1% of us who have these tendencies? Could it be that the criminals who've been unleashed and the psychopaths who are amongst us would suddenly, instead of becoming a burden on the criminal justice system or the NHS, would they suddenly become an asset to the authorities? Would they be given a gun and told, keep the rest of them, the decent people, the rational ones, the frightened ones, keep them in order, make them work, make them rebuild nuclear Britain? Well, I was in London last week for some nuclear research, visited a few interesting sites. What I'm going to do is start a YouTube channel. I actually already have a YouTube channel called The Atomic Hobo, if you want to subscribe, but I haven't given it much attention recently. It's mainly just very amateur videos of some bunkers I visited and my Chernobyl trip. I also uploaded some of my podcasts to it because feedback had told me that a lot of you prefer to listen to podcasts on YouTube, but looking at the stats, no one's bothering. It's getting maybe a few hundred at most. So I'm not going to bother uploading the podcast to it anymore. What I'm going to do is start creating a series of proper YouTube channels based on each podcast episode, based on whatever random horrible nuclear topic enchants me at the moment, and some properly made videos of my trips to nuclear bunkers and nuclear sites across Britain and across Europe. So that will be popping up over the next few weeks. So subscribe on YouTube to The Atomic Hobo and sit tight and wait for some juicy nuclear content. Also, my trip to London involved visits to some nuclear archives, and I sent postcards out to my patrons, the ones who are at the level of receiving nuclear postcards, so I hope they all arrived safely. Those of you who are in America or Australia, I don't know how quickly the post is. Maybe they've arrived yet, maybe not, but they should be on the way from London. And they included some juicy little snippets that I'd found in the nuclear archives. Now, if you have any questions you want to ask me about the podcast or about my research or about the upcoming YouTube channel, get me on Twitter at Julie A. McDowell. Get me on my Facebook page, which is called Nuclear Britain, or through my website, juliemcdowell.com. If you want to support the podcast on Patreon, please pop along to the website, which is patreon.com/atomichobo. You can sign up for whatever level you like, whatever amounts you'd like to donate, and you get different levels of rewards, one of which, the top level, is a free signed copy of my book, and you get your name in the acknowledgement section. I don't know yet when that book will appear, but I'm certainly doing my hardest to get it written, get it out there. Hopefully there'll be some updates coming soon about that. So pop along to Patreon if you want to support The Atomic Hobo and get some of these nuclear rewards. And before we go, let me thank all my patrons. Obviously, everyone pays at a different level. Thanks to every single one, even those who donate £1 a month. It is hugely appreciated. It allows me to keep this podcast going. It's allowing me to start up this new YouTube channel. Thank you to everyone who supports this podcast through Patreon. Let me give a special thank you to Arika, Jacqueline Brick, Jonathan Abelins, Andrew Key, Sam Marco, Richard Grundy, Dave Marks, Alan Christie, Helen McHale, Ewan McLeod, Douglas Greenshields, Colin McGee, Sean Milson, Brian Outlaw, Damian Ryan, Peter Lee, Adam Spink, Ian McCulloch, Linda Woolnough, Kevin Booter, Simon Allison, Sean Judge, Paul Maxwell Walters, Wynne Grant, Ben Capper, Mary Freer, Phil Catling, Steve Sace, Claire Brennan, Paul Jonathan Viner, and Gordy McNair. And that's us for this week, and all that remains is to say thank you for listening, and I'll be back next week with another podcast. Bye for now.